You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by the MLB.com Shop.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to MLB.com Extras. I'm Matthew Leach. I will be talking National League East with MLB.com's five NL East beat reporters. We'll be talking Cole Hamels and the front office. When we talk Phillies, we'll be talking James Shields and Danny Heron and the Marlins. We'll be talking the Braves' present and future. We'll be talking the Mets' present and their chances of contention, and we'll be talking about exactly how the pieces are going to fit together on those National League favorite Washington Nationals. Thanks, everybody, for listening to MLB.com Extras. Talking Washington Nationals with MLB.com's Nationals beat reporter, Bill Ladson. Bill, the biggest transaction since the last time we talked was the signing of Casey Jansen, who's kind of an interesting pitcher. He doesn't necessarily fit in the Nationals' mold, but it seems like he's a guy they like a lot. How exactly does he fit into that bullpen?
Well, he's going to be a setup guy for sure. He's going to give the ball to Drew Storen. He essentially replaces Tyler Clipper. I'm kind of surprised. You said it best. I mean, he's not a strikeout pitcher like Clipper was. But, what happened to him last year, I think the Nationals believe that was a fluke. He was food poisoned last year and had a bad second half on account of it. He lost 10 pounds. And, we'll see what happens. But I believe we'll see other pitchers, in the bullpen as well, besides Casey Jansen. We'll probably see, Blake Treinen. And we'll see what happens when it's over.
How does Tanner Roark fit into all that if he's presumably not going to be in the rotation?
Well, the way I look at it, he's probably going to be a long reliever, and that's how he started. He started as a long reliever, did a great job before he was put in the rotation, and that's pretty much it.
Is there an opportunity, just as good as he was as a starter, and sometimes that translates into real success in the bullpen, do you think there's an opportunity for him to maybe pitch his way into a more prominent late inning, not necessarily ninth, but for him to pitch his way into a late inning role, or is he a guy they'll want to keep as kind of a swingman, six starter type?
I think he would be kept as a swingman. You remember too now, if Gio Gonzalez gets off to a slow start, I wouldn't be surprised if Tanner Roark was given a chance to be in that rotation again. So it's going to be interesting when spring training starts.
That's interesting you say that. So to you, you see Gonzalez as maybe having a little bit of a short leash?
It wouldn't surprise me. I mean, he's coming off a disappointing year. He also didn't pitch well in the postseason. I think it's going to be somewhat of a short leash. There's no question about it. I think if he falters, yes, I think Matt Williams wouldn't hesitate to put in Tanner Roark, to be honest.
And I'm looking at the depth chart here, and I'm looking at the names, and there are a lot of kind of interesting names, but even with Jansen, I do wonder, is there enough there? Are they still looking for maybe another arm or two to bolster that relief corps?
I don't think so, Matthew. I think they're satisfied with what they have. You got to remember, too, they acquired some pitchers who they signed to minor league deals, like Heath Bell. So, maybe Heath Bell can come through. You just never know. But, it's a wait and see. You just never know what's going to happen.
And that's certainly more true of a bullpen than anything else. That's certainly one area where you really don't have much of a read on how it's going to shake down. The other sort of news right now in Nationals land has nothing to do with the roster and has everything to do with some facility stuff. It looks like they're getting very close to getting a deal done on a new spring training site. Vieira is a long way from a lot of other clubs, and there's nothing wrong with it, but it's also not necessarily one of the top facilities around. How big a deal will it be for them to get what seems to be a new state-of-the-art spring training franchise?
I think it's a big deal, Matthew, and the Nationals will be close to teams like the Cardinals, the Mets, and the Marlins. I mean, this is to the road trips will be much shorter than they were. I mean, the biggest hurt, the thing that hurt them the most when the Dodgers left and moved to Phoenix, And they used to play the Dodgers a lot when they were in Florida. And once they left, the road trips became brutal. So I think it's a great move for the Nationals, and I think it will definitely help the team in terms of the road trips, and you get more of the players going on these road trips now.
Is it accurate to say, is my understanding correct, as far as you know, that this really is, with this latest move, pretty close, maybe at the 10-yard line or so?
Yes, it's pretty close, and it's going to happen. It's going to happen in 2 years. Their lease in Vieira runs out in 2017, and they will share it with the Astros, and it looks like things are really rolling. I mean, based on the release that came out with Mark Lerner, said they were really happy with the results that happened the other day.
All right. Back to the baseball side. Last time we talked, it was right about as the Max Scherzer deal was getting done, and none of us really knew what the plan was as far as fitting him in and all of that. Now, we're a couple of weeks down the road, and all indications are they're not going to trade anybody. I think
Correct.
That's defensible. I think there's a real strong case for you only have so many chances to win a World Series, and this may be one.
Correct.
Is that your understanding, that as things stand now, unless they just get blown away, they're going to go to spring training and to opening day with the guys they have and not trade anybody away?
That's correct, Matthew. I mean, from what I understand, they're going to keep it as is right now. But, if, you know, like, again, I'll say it again. I still believe Ian Desmond is gone unless they can come up with a kind of deal for him. And now, you know, if you think about it, after giving Max Scherzer this deal, you got to wonder now what Jordan Zimmermann and Ian Desmond are thinking. You know, if you can give him the money, you can give us some money. So it's going to be interesting when they get to spring training. I'm sure they're going to be some fences mended somehow. And I wouldn't be surprised if they try to get a deal done. We'll see what happens.
And that leads into the next thing I was going to ask. Sometimes you'll see a guy, you know, when I was covering Albert Pujols, he cut it off the day he started working out. It wasn't even getting it to opening day. It was when he started working out, when spring was underway, he was done talking. Some players will wait till opening day. Different players will have different lines as far as how far, how long they're willing to talk. With the Nationals' various prominent free agents, do you get the impression that there are any of those early deadlines, or do they at least have spring training to try and work out deals with whatever these guys they want to keep?
I think they have until spring training. And the reason I say that, Matthew, is that Ian Desmond, Jordan Zimmermann, they have a lot of respect for Mike Rizzo. They really do. And I think they also get along with the Lerner family as well. So I think it's not going to be any bitter discussions at all. I think it's going to be, you know, mending fences and try to get a deal done. I really believe that's going to happen.
Out of that group of guys, and as we've discussed before, it's a very big group of guys.
Yes.
Or at least a very big group of significant players. Who do you think, as of right now, is most likely to get a deal done to stick around in Washington beyond 2015?
Wow. I'm going to say Ian Desmond. And the reason I say that is because of the way he gets along with the Lerner family and all the off-the-field stuff he does for the Nationals and also his respect for Mike Rizzo. I know Ian Desmond wants a deal done. I know he wants to be a National for life. But at the same time, as I say that, I know that Mike Rizzo won't hesitate to make a deal if it's necessary. So, everything's going to be amicable, and I think things will work out in the long run. I think it's going to be Ian Desmond.
You make an interesting point about ownership, and I think it's one that people, the fans, often forget. And honestly, sometimes media even forget. We talk so much about the general manager, and yet when you talk about these kinds of deals, the deal that it would likely take to keep Ian Desmond around, the deal that it would likely take to keep Jordan Zimmermann around, you're talking about deals that really are as much about ownership as anybody. Ownership's got to be the one to sign off to spend the money. Do you get the impression that ownership is motivated to keep this core together at least as much as possible for the long term?
Yes, because I think the Lerner family wants to win. They want to win badly. They really do, especially for the head man, Ted Lerner. And he's 89 years old now. There's no question. I mean, he's the one that gets these deals done, really, after, you know, it has to go through him before Mike Rizzo. So I'm telling you, that's how Max Scherzer got done. That's how Jason Worth got done, was through Ted Lerner. So it's going to be interesting to see how, you know, how involved he's going to be, Ted Lerner will be, once spring training starts.
All right. Well, Bill Ladson, thanks for taking some time to chat here on MLB.com Extras. Talking Atlanta Braves with MLB.com's Braves beat reporter, Mark Bowman. Mark, the Braves continue to tinker and do a few things around the edges of the roster. Most recent thing since we talked is finalizing a deal with Johnny Gomes. How does he fit in with what the Braves are trying to accomplish?
Well, you know, first of all, you know, it all comes down to what the guy can offer you on the field. And they see Johnny Gomes as a guy who will spend some, let's say he'll spend, you know, a majority of his time in left field, but he'll get most of his at-bats against left-handed pitchers. He's a guy that also can come off the bench in late games if they do use a platoon situation there, which is, maybe it's not a strict platoon all the time, but I think we'll be seeing that used most of the time with Zoilo Almonte getting a lot of the at-bats against right-handed pitchers. That provides Gomes a chance, like I said, to come off the bench as a pinch hitter against some of the left-handers he'd see in the later innings. At the same time, they went after Johnny Gomes just to add another strong presence to the clubhouse that was it lacked leadership last year. And you know, you can say in the 14 years I've covered this team, I'd say it was that the one clubhouse that lacked life. And you can take two steps back to, well, that's because they were losing. And most of the other teams I've covered have been winners. And there's some validity to that. But I do think that they needed somebody to step up once they lost Tim Hudson, a strong personality. In essence, they lost Chris Medlin last year, another strong personality when he was injured because, you know, he wasn't providing that same presence in the clubhouse. And, you know, for so many years, the Braves have had strong personalities from the days of Maddox, Glavine, Smoltz, to Chipper carrying on that torch. They bring in Johnny Gomes and A.J. Pierzynski. They're two guys that can, you know, provide some leadership in that clubhouse and maybe show some of these young guys that are going to be the future of this club, you know, the way to approach a game.
You mentioned Pierzynski, which leads into one of the other things I wanted to talk about. The Braves have been amassing catchers at an amazing rate. And I realize to some extent that's a position that every organization just needs. You need catchers. But they've acquired some guys who are, you know, even borderline major league catchers. And given that they have a guy that they're awfully high on that seems to be the regular, and they got another guy who's been a regular in Pierzynski, is it anything beyond just deepening a position where you always want depth to this amassing of catchers?
Yeah, you know, they really were weak from an organizational standpoint in terms of depth, you know, at the catcher's position. So there were some of these moves had to do with, were influenced by that reality. But let's take a look at Bethancourt. Bethancourt is the catcher of the future. Their plan is for him to be their everyday catcher this year, or be their primary catcher this year. But what if something goes wrong in spring training? What if something, you know, they take a step back and say, whether he gets injured, or they say, you know what, maybe he does need a little bit more time in at the minor league level, or let's even take it a step further. Why don't we just bring these guys into camp so he doesn't get comfortable and think this spot's his? Because, you know, we've talked in the past, effort level is where that has been a complaint about Bethancourt in the past. We saw it late last year. He didn't maybe look like he was providing sufficient effort behind the plate, blocking balls, getting just some balls in the dirt, that kind of stuff. So, you know, Bethancourt is a guy for the future. He's a guy they're relying on, but at the same time, they've got a little bit of a safety net here with John Buck. Jesus Flores, they brought him in as well. You know, there's a chance that both those guys start this season at Gwinnett. Probably one of them, I guess, would be Flores. You know, if there is not a need for him near the end of camp, you know, they'll either, you know, try to deal him to another club or, you know, in some way try to move him. I don't really see him sticking around the organization if he's going to Gwinnett. With John Buck, they have not ruled out the possibility of carrying three catchers to begin the year. They did it last year. Their thinking is that, hey, look, this allows for some more pinch hit opportunities. Now, with Ryan Domet last year being a left-handed hitter, they probably were in really not being much of a catcher at all. It was more of a just a theory or it was an approach and principle to say, hey, look, we have three catchers on the roster. Here with John Buck, you do have a guy who has some pop. That maybe you do carry him just to have another big bat off your bench or a guy who could provide some power in the later innings. And then the other thing is this, you know, if one of these guys get hurt, you bring in John Buck here with this minor league deal. If at least you have that if something goes wrong, he's there to step in and provide some of the bats for a couple of weeks or a month or whatever needs to happen. And then if you take another step further, a lot of the fans, I know we're talking last week when they traded David Hale, who, you know, he was a long shot to win the fifth spot in the rotation. And the Braves have really viewed him as a long reliever. They dealt him and got Schlosser, a guy who had been non-tendered and then came back and signed a minor league deal. They went ahead and traded them to the Rockies for two catchers. Bursino is really intriguing. He's a young kid that played 4 years of rookie ball, came up to the A-ball level last year, showed a little bit of power. Eddie Perez saw him in the Venezuelan Winter League this year when he was managing down there and really liked his bat. You know, time will tell whether he will be a catcher, but you know, they saw this as an opportunity to get a kid, you know, that has a little bit of power potential. We haven't really seen it in the numbers yet. I think the most home runs he's hitting in the season is 12 or so. So you haven't really seen it, but he's got a little bit of bat behind him. The catching numbers are pretty good at the lower levels, but I'll take the evaluation of a guy who caught as long as Eddie Perez and said, you know, we'll see if he can catch at the big league level. So if he can't, maybe that's another position he goes to. This was just an opportunity to deal from an area surplus with the pitchers that they sent to Colorado and then try to strengthen their organizational depth at the catching position.
And then one other move this club has made since the last time we talked, they finally, also a move that seemed to be in the works for a long time, they finally got a deal done with Deon Toscano. He seems like kind of an interesting guy, kind of a maybe not a power guy, but an interesting player. What do they think they have in him?
You know, right now I think they're confident they have at least a guy who can be a fourth outfielder at the big league level. He is relatively unknown. You know, he did not play a lot or did not play at all on the international or internationally for Cuba. He tried to leave the country a few times and he got in trouble and was never able to be seen by scouts. And when he made his way to the Dominican Republic last year, some scouts started to get word about who he was. And Gordon Blakely, who Braves brought into their organization, very, very good on the international front. He arranged a workout for him the same time that Freddie Gonzalez and Kevin Seitzer were down there to look at Yasmani Thomas, who ended up signing with the Diamondbacks. They looked at Toscano at the same time. And, you know, look, Thomas and Toscano are not the same kind of player. So, you know, Thomas has a chance to be an impact player in the D-backs organization. Toscano could be, you know, at least a fourth outfielder at the big league level, a guy who could play both corner positions. It doesn't seem like he'd probably be much of a fit in the center field. He's a good contact guy. That's what he projects to be, a contact bat, a guy who's had some decent on-base percentages during his days down there in Cuba. So he might just be a good piece. He's probably never going to be a difference maker. But they didn't spend a whole lot of money on him, and they've said they're going to be aggressive in that international market. This is a further indication that they're following through with that plan.
All right. Well, Mark Bowman, thanks for taking some time to chat here on MLB.com Extras. Talking New York Mets with MLB.com's Mets beat reporter Anthony DiComo. So we've been waiting and waiting and waiting to see a Dillon G trade, and it was coming, and it was coming, and now it's not coming, maybe? Where does that stand right now?
Yeah, that's pretty much as good as I could describe it. You know, it's the one move that really, since December, we've all been waiting for, and it seems very likely. Sandy Ellerson hasn't really disguised it. He's put Dillon G out there, along with, to a lesser extent, John Neese and Bartolo Colon, but G's the guy they were really looking to trade. And, you know, it seems like they weren't looking for a ton, but maybe they were looking for more than we thought, because they hadn't gotten an offer. And now we've reached a point in the offseason where most of the free agents are signed, James Shields being the prominent exception. Even the lesser guys, for the most part, are signed. You've seen some trades. So the teams that were out there that were looking for rotation help, by and large, have found it. Which could make it a situation now where the Mets are going to hang on to Dillon G. And that's going to be an issue in spring training. They're going to have six guys for five spots. And it would look like G would probably be the odd man out in that. And, you know, you could stick him in the bullpen. He's making about $5 million this year, which is probably more than you'd want to allot for a long reliever with a $100 million payroll. But it looks like that's what the Mets may wind up doing. I wouldn't rule out a trade these last few weeks of spring training, but it certainly seems a lot less likely than it was coming out of the chute a couple of months ago.
Do you think there is some kind of baseball case here for holding on to this guy? I mean, I know there's a lot in the pipeline, but there's also a lot of sort of uncertainty regarding what goes on beyond the front of this rotation. There's a lot of just sort of not really sure what you're going to get from the kids. You know, the way to develop one pitcher is to have 10 prospects. For a team that has designs on competing, do you think there really is an argument to be said that, look, I know it's a little awkward at first, but nobody goes through a season only using five starters, and maybe if you don't actually need the money and maybe you're not getting a guy who helps you win this year, maybe what you do is, in fact, just say, okay, we got six starters and let it work itself out?
Sure. And my personal opinion from the start was that they really didn't need to be doing this for just those reasons. The Mets have sort of justified it or justified their search by saying, you know, we have Noah Syndergaard down there. We have Rafael Montero. We have Steven Matz, who should be ready, you know, by the middle end of the season. So we've got that depth that teams don't have, and G's really just excess at this point. You know, you can argue that trading G, and I know a lot of fans would like the payroll to be well higher than it is, but that's just not going to happen. So the argument for trading G is that's $5 million that you can spend at the trade deadline on something that you really need at that point. But personally, I'm with you. Yeah, I'd rather have as many starters as possible. You know, someone is going to get hurt, probably more than one person. There's going to be things that happen. And if by some miracle, you know, you have this problem where you've got nine starters who are all major league ready and ready to go in the middle of the season, maybe the market for G is better then than it is now. So I'm with you. I would keep the guy. I would stick him in the bullpen. Yeah, there'll be some hurt feelings, but this is the major leagues, and that's not really how teams should be conducting business, is based on hurt feelings. So, it's definitely a baseball factor there that you can say the Mets are better off keeping him.
We've talked a lot about it. There's probably no topic we've talked about more than shortstop and Wilmer Flores, but you addressed it again recently in an Around the Horn piece. We're just about at spring training, and there's still not another shortstop on the roster, still not another shortstop who's been brought in. I feel like we can't not ask it at this point, but Wilmer Flores goes into camp as the shortstop, or is there any kind of complications beyond that?
No, I mean, he's the guy, and it's funny because, you know, in talking with Sandy Ellerson, he laughed a couple of weeks ago when I was talking to him, because I said, you know, the same thing, I have to ask you, and I know that you said in September that Wilmer Flores is probably going to be the shortstop, and I know that you said it in October, and then in November, and then in December, and then in January. But, you know, everyone was just sort of waiting. A lot of people maybe crossing their fingers, or a lot of people just curious to see what the Mets did, if they would swing a trade, or if they would go out and sign someone. It's not happening. It hasn't happened. It certainly doesn't look like it's going to happen. So Wilmer Flores is going to be that guy. He's been down in Florida probably about for a month already, working out with the training system they have there, the Mike Barwis methods, which is a new complex they opened up down there. And it's the same sort of regimen that he was on in Michigan last year when he went up for a couple weeks during the winter. He got a lot out of that. He really swears by it. He came to camp thinner, leaner, and really had a good season. He struggled a little bit when he came up, but finished strong in September offensively, and defensively he held his own. So, the argument that it's going to work out is that he can do just that, hold his own, and really be elite offensively for the position. He's a guy who profiles as maybe hitting in that 260 to 270 range, 16 home runs, something like that, which would be a nice boost at the bottom of their lineup. Now, is it a house of cards that could come falling down? If he's just a disaster defensively at shortstop, or even if he doesn't hit, which is possible, sure, of course. But given the alternatives that were out there, the Mets overturned a lot of stones and decided that sticking with Wilmer was their best option. So, that's what it's going to be. That's the guy you're going to see out there come opening day.
And you touched on what, to me at this point, is probably the most interesting story about Flores, which is the whole the conditioning thing. I mean, how much of a difference has it made and could it make going forward to his viability as a shortstop if he is able to continue to maintain and maybe even improve his fitness, his movement, his essentially just his build?
Yeah, I mean, quickness, flexibility, all that is part of it. All that is stuff that he really got a lot better at last year. And a lot of these Mets guys are swearing by this system that they're all using now, or a large part of the roster is using. And I know there's some stories out there about Mets guys who are paying for the service, even though it's at the Mets complex. And it was a little bit of a mini controversy a while back. But the fact is, a lot of these guys really like the system. A lot of these guys have chosen to go down to Florida months early so that they can train here, as opposed to paying for their own personal trainer back home. Lucas Duda is sort of the poster child of this whole thing. He spent a lot of time working with Mike Barwis last winter and wound up having a career year. And Flores, too. Flores really broke out 2 years ago in the minors and held on to his gains last year while getting better defensively. So, that's really just sort of what they're hoping for, is that a continuation of that he comes into camp even more in shape, even more flexible, maybe adding a little bit of muscle while staying quick, staying agile. And those are the things that can only help at shortstop, because, really, this is a guy who came up as a shortstop in the minor leagues. All along, scouts said he's too big, he's too awkward, he'll never stay there. And it almost became a self-fulfilling prophecy for him. Whereas, now that he's back at the position after playing second base and third base for a long while, you wonder, why couldn't this guy play? He seems, and not that he's ever going to be Omar Vizquel out there, but he seems to have a handle for the routine plays. He's not going to be spectacular, but the Mets don't need him to be. As long as he hits and as long as he does make those routine plays and doesn't kill you on defense, I think it's a risk the Mets are clearly willing to take.
Do you think there's any more, not big moves, but any more kind of housekeeping around the edges moves that this club might make before camp opens, bench, bullpen, anything like that?
Really, no. I've been covering the team for, 6-7 years now, and this is the most remarkably set roster I've ever seen going into spring training. The lineup 1-8 is set. The bench is pretty much set with really no competitions at all on the bench. The rotation, might have a little question now with Dylan G in there, but, the top five and top six in that depth chart is pretty obvious. And the bullpen, they've got their top five guys, not even counting Bobby Parnell, who probably won't be healthy to start the season, in place already. So in terms of major position battles, sort of drama going into spring training, there's really nothing. They might add a couple more relievers on minor league deals. They might add a bench guy or something to compete. But really, anything they do at this point forward, barring a surprise Dylan G trade, will just be to add organizational depth to fill out those minor league depth charts and all that. You know, really going into spring training, all the drama is going to come from one guy, and that's Matt Harvey. You know, how is he going to fit? Are the Mets going to start him opening day or look elsewhere? What are they going to do to limit his innings? Pretty much all of that drama that usually revolves around roster spots and who's going to do this and who's going to play where is going to settle on Matt Harvey, and you're going to see a lot of storylines coming out of that in the next few weeks and months.
Sounds like fun. Anthony DiComo, thanks for taking some time to chat here on MLB.com Extras. Talking Miami Marlins with MLB.com's Marlins beat reporter, Joe Fusaro. Joe, to come back to a topic that we seem to be coming to nearly every week, and one that we're probably doing in about 7 of the 10 AL and NL East podcasts this week, James Shields is still out there, and the Marlins still seem to be lying in the weeds. Maybe not most aggressive, but there certainly does seem to be a continual drumbeat, at least, quietly at least, between them and him. Where does that stand? Is that reasonable? Is that viable? Where are they at with that as that presumably comes close to finally getting resolved?
Yeah, Matthew, if you had asked a couple of weeks ago, I would say no chance. You know, absolutely door shut. He's still out there, and from what I'm hearing is don't be surprised, you know, and talks, there have been talks, and that dialogue has continued for a while, and I think this is at a very sensitive time in the whole process, and I think it's going on at the absolute top end of the organization in terms of do they feel he's the guy that puts them over the top and can they squeeze the dollars in without risking future budgets down, and we're talking about 17, 18 and beyond, and, you know, really kind of make a lot of noise in the NL East this year, and I think all those discussions are going on right now.
What do you think it would take from Shields' camp to get a deal done with the Marlins? Because I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that if this becomes some sort of all-out bidding war, if people go crazy, if this starts becoming yeah. 5 years and 100 or whatever it may be, that's not the area the Marlins would be likely to play in.
Correct.
So,
yeah, I think they're out. Yeah, I think their comfort level. I think their ideal level would be the 3 years, and let's say he's looking at, you know, in the four, you know, the $50 million range. You know, we have to kind of figure that out. How, you know, he turned down the 15-3 from the Royals, so you got to figure he's going to get an increase there. You know, maybe not $20 million a year, but the 17 and a half, get it done. You know, over three years with an option, let's say, you know, maybe something like that can be worked out. I think the key from the Marlins standpoint is they know they have this window right now. And, yes, they're going for it without, you know, trying to make the mistakes of the past where they went over $100 million when they really weren't primed to take on that kind of payroll. They did that in 12, obviously. So to not, you know, shatter what they were, you know, their payroll model that they had kind of drawn up. This is going to come down to, you know, Jeffrey Loria saying, yes, this player gets us into the postseason, and yes, I will, you know, stretch the payroll and try to get this deal done.
And we can't really talk about Shields or the Marlins rotation without talking about the other variable that's still clearly there, which is the Dan Herron situation. We obviously don't know a lot more now than we did a week or 2 weeks ago, and I guess we don't really know until camp starts. But is there anything different about Herron's situation than 2 weeks ago or a month ago or 2 months ago?
I think one reason why the Marlins are not going away on Shields is I don't think they're completely convinced Herron is all in. You know, whether he, you know, feels that you know, he's saying he's reporting, and all indications are that's what's going to happen. But let's say he does opt to retire. You know, once he gets here, doesn't seem to really feel like this is right for him. Or let's say, you know, he's, you know, demanding a trade. Well, if Shields signs with San Diego, there goes a West Coast team, and there aren't too many of them that are in the market for starting pitcher. So it's almost like it'd be kind of interesting that, you know, if Shields were to sign with the Padres, that could have impacted the Marlins as well. I think again, one reason why, another reason why they're in on Shields is, let's say Heron's not on board and he is not part of the plan. Now you're really going with your homegrown guys, and you know, and hoping that they are going to take you to that next level. And I think they want as many sure bets as possible. So still a TBA on Dan Heron.
But it's not a situation where they couldn't have both Heron and Shields, is it?
That's, I think, they're trying to figure out, you know, whether that means, you know, they sign. Let's say they were hypothetically to get James Shields. I don't think it necessarily the same day has to be Dan Heron traded to, you know, San Diego or San Francisco or someplace out west. And then, you know, the team signed Shields. I think that, you know, you take him on Shields and then you kind of figure it out with Heron and see whether you can move him in spring training or, you know, whether or not you indeed can keep him. But I would think you would have to budget assuming that he will stay. I mean, I don't really see how you avoid that. So, again, yeah, these are tough business decisions, and those are the type of decisions that they're going to have to resolve probably in a pretty quick manner.
So on the offensive side of the ball, the biggest news since the last time we talked, the Marlins made a very big deal of signing Ichiro Suzuki. They traveled to Japan, had a news conference there. It was clearly a big deal for the organization. And yet, Ichiro is an outfielder, and the Marlins have three pretty good outfielders. How exactly does he fit on the roster of the 2015 Marlins?
Yeah, it's another storyline that's going to be fun to follow in camp and into the season. I think the Marlins just view Ichiro as the ultimate insurance policy. You know, they have three very, you know, talented young outfielders, but you also had the situation with Stanton and his serious injury in September, getting hit by the pitch. And, you know, if he needs some time or has any kind of setbacks, you know, you got Ichiro as you know, quick fill-in. And Ozuna also missed time late in the year with an ankle injury. And, you know, Yelich and earlier in the year had a little DL stint. So, yeah, it's going to be a challenge to get that guy onto the field. But I think it's a nice problem that the Marlins feel they have. And as much as you draw up every year that this will be our team and nothing will change that, things happen and things usually have a way of working themselves out. So Ichiro will get his playing time as much as they can get him in there. But here's a guy that, you know, obviously been a regular for 14 years, and it's going to be more of an adjustment for him to see, you know, how he can perform in a spot role.
Do you get the impression? I mean, I guess obviously so. He's a bright guy. He can look at the roster, and he chose to sign there. But do you get the impression that he's fully on board with the situation? I mean, he hasn't seemed to be a guy who's been particularly thrilled about playing part-time in recent years. Is there any potential for this to be not a good problem, but just a problem?
Yeah, you know, the fit all along seemed very curious to me for those reasons and why he wouldn't want to necessarily stay in the American League where he could DH. But, you know, all indications were, you know, they kind of had, you know, they targeted him. They looked at others. The Marlins did. They looked at, like, Nature Holt as more of that defined lefty bat off the bench role. And yet, Ichiro knew very much what he was coming into, and he also knows where his status is, 156 hits shy of 3,000. And I guess he was confident enough, and they presented it enough that, you know, opportunity would be here for him to get on the field, and he bought into that. If he didn't, you know, it's going to definitely create a problem in the clubhouse. But all signs right now are that, you know, he kind of knew what he was getting into, and we shall see how it pans out.
And then beyond James Shields, there is one other noteworthy free agent, still in the market, now in the market, and that's Yoan Moncada. Do you get the impression that the Marlins will be any kind of a serious player for him?
Matthew, no. I mean, it's in terms of the talent, yes, but in terms of that, you know, 100% tax that's going to come with the price tag, and you have to pay that one lump sum, and it's my understanding, like in June, they don't have that. You know, let's say it takes, you know, $30 million to sign them, to cut $30 million more to the commissioner's office is, you know, in one check is not really where the Marlins are right now, and I think that's really going to make his market very curious. That seems like it's narrowing him to the biggest markets
the LA Dodger type, New York Yankee types.
Well, Joe Fusaro, thanks for taking some time to chat here on MLB.com Extras. Talking Philadelphia Phillies with MLB.com's Phillies beat reporter, Todd Zielecki. Todd, it seems like we continue to talk about the future years even beyond this year, even as this year approaches. It's been a kind of a consistent theme here. And there's been some interesting developments in the front office, and I wonder, with the changes, with the cementing of some roles, with David Montgomery's return, what do you think all of this means, not so much this season, but sort of going forward, kind of directionally for the Phillies front office?
Well, I think if anything, it further cements the philosophy that they are going to be rebuilding for the future. You know, when David was president, I think they were still very much in the, you know, we can still win this thing type of mode. And Pat Gillick has definitely shifted course. And now that Pat is kind of solidified as president, I think they're going to continue on that path. So with Pat Gillick in charge, he's going to be working hand-in-hand with Amaro in terms of rebuilding this team. So I think you're going to continue to see them be aggressive, or as aggressive as they can be, in trying to trade guys like Cole Hamels, Jonathan Papelbon, when he gets healthy or he proves he's healthy, Cliff Flea. Chase Utley is still on the team. Ryan Howard is still on the team. Anybody, I think, that is making considerable money and is over the age of 30, pretty much, I think, is going to be available for a trade at some point. And I think you'll continue to see these guys work. Even if it doesn't happen before spring training, I think they're still going to make calls during spring training. I think they're going to make calls in April. I think they're going to keep on going until they complete some of these changes.
You had a piece today that addresses or that included Montgomery addressing to some extent the future of Ruben Amaro. What's your understanding of that situation? I mean, it seemed mostly supportive. It didn't seem like the dreaded vote of confidence, but at the same time, it seemed maybe a half step less black and white than nearly every other previous statement about Ruben Amaro's future has been.
Yeah, I agree with that. Pat Gillick, when he was interim president in August, when he replaced David Montgomery, he threw all of his support behind Ruben. He's maintained that to this point. David Montgomery said same thing today on MLB Network Radio, that you know, they believe Ruben's the right guy for the job. But he did. He kind of threw a little gray area in there when he said, but I will say that the ownership group is looking at this very closely. And he said, you know, after a year or two of Pat working closely with Ruben, he'll be able to get an idea how effective Ruben is for the job. And then he said something I thought was interesting. He said a collective decision will be made at that point. So certainly I think things are up in the air. And I think the best thing that could happen for Ruben, because they pretty much said they're not going to compete this year, so I don't know how much wins and losses are going to affect his job status. But I think if some of these young guys make some nice progress this season, if a lot of the prospects that they acquired in some of these trades make some nice progress this season, if they can trade a Papelbon and a Lee and a Hamels and they can get a good return for those guys, I think that would bode well for Ruben. But, you know, things certainly get a lot shakier if some of the guys in the big leagues take a step back or some of these prospects don't look like they're going to pan out. So it's going to be a really fascinating year for Ruben in kind of to try to figure out what direction the Phillies are going to go down the road in terms of the GM.
And you touched on this to some extent already, but the issue of Cole Hamels has appeared again, because it's going to keep appearing. Anytime there's a lull in baseball news, somebody's going to start talking or asking about Cole Hamels. It seemed like his name kind of burbled up again within the last week or so. Do you think that's any closer to having clarity or resolution, or is it really mostly at this point just people who need something to write asking the same questions again?
Yeah, no, I think what's going on is this. The Phillies, rightly or wrongly, feel that they don't need to move Cole Hamels right now. So they are waiting to get one top prospect that they really covet. In other words, they're not going to take some guys that they're not totally in love with, or the one big prospect that they're totally not in love with, just to get Cole Hamels out of the organization. So what I think is happening right now is they're kind of holding firm with their demands from particular teams. I think there was a report that the Red Sox are saying no for Mookie Betts, and I think a Swigart, the catching prospect for the Red Sox, they're not ready to trade those guys, or they're unwilling to trade those guys. They're non-starters, and I think if the Red Sox would call up the Phillies today and say, you know what, we thought about it, we'll give you Mookie Betts for Cole Hamels and a couple, you know, some other prospects and Mookie Betts for Cole Hamels, I think boom, the deal would get done. But until that point, I think the Phillies are going to wait and see what happens in spring training. Pat Gillick said that recently. He thinks that there could be increased interest in spring training. We've seen it happen before. A pitcher gets hurt, pitcher goes down. All of a sudden, oh my gosh, we need an ace. We need to do something. Let's circle back to Cole Hamels. So I think for that reason, it's very much a continual process, and it will be until they finally trade him at some point.
And then there was, within the last month or so, there was some at least smoke about Papelbon, and it seemed like something might be, if not done, at least getting close, and then it went quiet again. Do you think that was real? Do you think people got ahead of themselves, and do you think there's still some reasonable chance that Papelbon gets moved?
I think it's definitely real. The Phillies are definitely talking with the Brewers and the Blue Jays specifically about Papelbon. But I think what hurts the Phillies right now is that there are some other late inning options out there. They might not be as good as Papelbon, but you know, if I'm the Brewers or I'm the Blue Jays, I go, why would we give you one of our top prospects or this prospect that you like for Papelbon when we can go out and, you know, sign a free agent late inning guy and then maybe revisit this whole situation in June or July if the situation presents itself. So I think that's a big stumbling block for the Phillies right now, is that other teams do have options, so they don't necessarily hold all the cards. And then the other factor, of course, is he's making $13 million this year, and he's going to make $13 million next year, I think, if he finishes just 48 games. So you're going to have to eat the right amount of money and then get the prospect back that you want. And like I just said, you know, the other teams are going, we don't need to give you the prospects that we want or that you want, because we can still go out and maybe sign a free agent or two.
Was it your impression that they were, as these things, again, because it seemed like the report was that something was close. Is it your impression that maybe there was agreement on players and couldn't come to agreement on money, or what? How far along did they get, particularly with Milwaukee, as far as talk and deal?
Yeah, you know, I don't think it was as close as originally reported. I think that they were, let me put it this way, I think that they were having very serious discussions, but I don't know it was that close to being completed. I think they were definitely having serious conversations, and I still think that they are still having serious conversations, but I don't think anything was imminent. And at the last second, you know, the Brewers backed out, or the Phillies backed out because of money. So, but like I've been saying, the fact that they're still talking, I think, is, if you're a Phillies fan and you're trying to get younger, or you want to see Papelbon get moved, the fact that the Phillies are actually still having discussions with teams is somewhat encouraging, because if they were that far apart and there was no reason to have a conversation, then they wouldn't be having conversations. But for whatever reason, Ruben Amaro Jr. is still talking to the front offices of Milwaukee and Toronto, because there's a reason to be talking. Now, it doesn't mean anything's going to get done, but it's, talking is better than not talking. At least you have a chance of getting some progress and making a deal happen.
Talked at some point on one of these podcasts with Larry Anderson, who had a real interesting theory that he advanced, that there might be reason to think that Ryan Howard, for a variety of reasons, might have a better year next year. And one of the things he pointed to was having some of his personal issues squared away and not having that eating at him quite so much this season. Do you think that may be a line of thought within the organization, and not so much that they would keep Howard in the long run, but that maybe, I mean, obviously, it's not going to be easy to move him regardless, but maybe there is some thought that if he has a little better year, if he's a little more right in some ways, that maybe there is still some chance that he could build some value for himself and make himself more tradable?
Yeah, I think so. I think there's more of a curiosity than anything else in the front office and among the coaching staff. They're kind of curious. you know, maybe they're being overly optimistic about it, but I think deep down they're going, okay, well, maybe now that this stuff is behind him and he's got a little bit of a clear head, maybe he will be a little bit more effective at the plate. Because, you know, the personal stuff that he was going through with his family, I mean, that would weigh on anybody, I think, and really kind of just, you know, be a huge, huge distraction for you going to work every day and you know, just playing the game. So I think there's definitely a curiosity about what kind of player he can be with a clear mind. And, you know, he's going to be a year removed from his Achilles and knee surgery. So, and the fact that I think that, you know, Ruben Amaro Jr. went on Philly radio a few weeks ago and said, you know, I told Ryan Howard, you know, we're better off without him. I think there's a lot of people wondering, is this guy going to be really motivated to kind of quiet his critics? And honestly, I think the Phillies would love that because it would make him more attractive to a team, you know, come July 31st. You know, if Howard all of a sudden starts hitting above 250 and shows a little bit more power, then all of a sudden, hey, you know, maybe they can work out a deal for him.
Yeah, you sure showed us, man.
yeah, exactly.
Todd Zielecki, thanks for taking some time to chat here on MLB.com Extras, and thanks everybody for listening.
Visit the official online shop of Major League Baseball at MLB.com/shop for the largest selection of authentic caps, t-shirts, jerseys, hoodies, collectibles, and more. Get your gear straight from the source, the MLB.com shop.